Okay, we might kick off now. So welcome to this session. This session is from the Superannuation Risk Management and FCR Task Force. This task force was set up a couple of years ago with initially a focus on promoting the use of FCRs in DC super funds in particular. It's an area where the Actuaries Institute has effectively moved in advance of legislation. We were looking to develop something that we thought would be both of interest and of use and of value to the industry, in particular DC super funds, and of course in promoting the benefits of using actuaries to expand the actuarial, role in DC super funds. Over its years, the task force has undertaken a range of activities. It's issued, as you would know, a practice guidance. It's dealt with APRA. It's put in submissions on prudential standards and the like. So it's been a very active period. Today, Jules will cover a range of topics, but the particular focus is on where we go to from here. In short, while the task force has been operating, the experience has been that even though we think, or indeed even though we know we have something of value for super funds, it's an area that's open to more providers than just actuaries. We don't have a statutory role, and we need to compete to get the work. Indeed, our feeling is that unless actuaries and the Institute heavily promote FCRs and the work of the Super Risk Management Task Force, we're in danger of being passed by. So the work of the Task Force has been, and continues to be, enthusiastic, a great deal of focus on getting things done, but we really want to focus and get your feedback today, and that'll be drawn out of Jules' presentation on how we promote and take it further from here. So with that, I'll turn over to Jules, but before I do, I'll read Jules' bio. Jules is an actuary with 25 years actuarial experience and is the director of Enterprise Metrics. He's a member of the Institute's council and, of course, of this task force. Jules has contributed to the development of the Institute's guidance on FCRs in developing our responses to APRA regarding superprudential supervision, practical experience in supporting clients with their MySuper applications, their op risk reserves, developing risk appetites and risk management strategies, and, of course, modelling portfolios of risks. So with that, I'll turn it over to Jules. Oh, Jules, are you happy to take questions as we go,
yep,
we go through?
Yep, happy, more than so happy to take questions
through,
as we go.
If you do ask questions, please, as is the convention, announce yourself and use the microphone, because these sessions are being recorded. And I will remind you that at the end I'll ask you to make sure you fill out your feedback form. So if you've got good points you want to say about Jules as you go through, maybe you should just jot them down before we get to the end.
Yeah, no bad points. They're not important.
Okay. Thank you, Jules.
Well, thanks, Brad, for the introduction. And I'd just like to reiterate that we really are looking for interaction and support and suggestions about how to effectively take FCRs in superannuation forward. And just as Brad was speaking, I mean, we have a challenge in the local sense about FCRs and super, but I think it's emblematic of broader challenges that are facing the Institute in general, about how do we get out of our comfort zone and our regulatory castle and move forward into an environment where we have competition. We may or may not be viewed as being the best or the best equipped, even though we believe genuinely that we are. So there's an interesting sort of test case, and I very much hope that we as a profession are able to do this and don't end up coming back here in 5 years' time and looking at our navels and going, oh, well, we had a good idea, but nobody listened to us, so we didn't do it. So that's the challenge that's sitting there. What I want to do here is take you through a bit of background, both about from the sort of super point of view and the FCR point of view, to sort of set the scene. And then I'll talk a little bit about whether there's a need for this or not, because I'll give you a few brief snippets from a survey that we, being the working group, and I in particular, because I was the bunny on the ground, did in conjunction with AIST, which was a repeat of a survey that was done by Darren and Brad in 2011. We did a 2013 version, and I'll give you a couple of snippets from that. And I think, whilst that's got lots of interesting stuff in it, the clear message from that is there's clearly a need for what we can do, and that need is not going away. So we've got some evidence to back up the fact that, you know, yeah, give me the chance. So a little bit about context, that particularly for those who maybe not super aficionados, but in essence, over the last couple of years, lots of things have been happening in the super spaces, we all know, starting from the Cooper Review, Stronger Super, and lots of shenanigans around that. But from our perspective, and from the super perspective in particular, this has all come out in a bunch of SPSs, Prudential Standards. And those Prudential Standards are enshrining, partly because APRA can, because they got the standard-setting power, but also because they got the harmonisation view, are enshrining stuff like good governance, risk management, stress testing, all those sorts of things. They're now coming out as you will do, not it might be a good idea for. Now, there's a plus and a minus sitting in that, and we need to recognise that. The plus is the issues have got recognition, right? That's good. The minus is that when we go out to talk to the industry, they don't see this as a plus. They see this as a necessary compliance or another necessary compliance burden, right? And there's varying degrees of that. I'm not criticising in a sense because lots of stuff is happening and this is just one more. But we have to make sure that if we go out and do this sort of work, this becomes not a compliance necessity. This becomes a useful value add to the users. And there's a serious challenge sitting in that for us because we have to communicate the good bits and deal with the bad bits. I know there are some in the room who are on both sides of this fence, so your views would be quite interesting. We focused on, as I said, governance and risk management. The only formal piece of capital required in super funds, and I've carefully said formal because it's not the only practical piece, is the ORFR, right, op risk reserve. That should be classic actuarial hinterland, despite the fact there is basically no data out there. So, and as APRA has said, trying to build an op risk model on an LDA basis, you know, don't bother at the moment. The data's not there. Cross off plan A, do plan B, whatever that turns out to be. So there's an opportunity sitting there right in its own right for some nice lateral, actuarial, informed thinking about how to effectively get through a place where there isn't much data and isn't going to be for a considerable time. So the need at the high level, funds are going to need to navigate their future environment, which is a bit choppy at the moment. So they need better understanding. They need more insight into what can happen. Now, for most of us, the future is fairly uncertain. If you're in one of those people who's in the category of, you know what's going to happen next year, then you don't need to stay because you've got some lines to various people that most of the rest of us haven't got. So the reality is it's uncertain. Uncertainty means you have a variety of outcomes. You don't know which one's going to be. We can add value in that sort of context by demanding people think about that, by educating them into the fact that this is, I mean, maybe not the words you'd use in general, but this is inherently statistical, deeply inherently statistical. How we communicate, that's a different question, but that's where we are. So we need insight, we need analysis. We don't need reporting of lots of data. We actually need analysis of what the data means to you as the client. So that means you've got to put your money where your mouth is. We've got to make recommendations. We've got to be prepared to offer views. You know, and all that sort of stuff. Some of that's characteristically unactuarial because you can't go, on the one hand, this. On the other hand, that. Oh, by the way, on the third hand, which is, you know, that's the one that's out here, we'll do the other. So, FCRs, all right, just by a quick way of back, long established internationally, right? It's not a new idea. And it's the only example I'm aware of where the analytic cycle of the actuarial practice control paradigm. The analytic cycles identify, solve, monitor. Or better, more generally, it's what's the problem? What did we do? Did it work? Which is a more useful way of thinking of it because then it's much more generally applicable. It's the only example of legislated APC. It's been around for a long time. Right? In law. In a number of countries. So, you know, this is not new. Well established in here in general insurance and health insurance. I think it's established in some other countries in general insurance. I don't know about anywhere else with health insurance, but someone could enlighten me on that. The reality is the concept is quite generic. There's no restriction to life insurance. It just happens to be where it grew up. Why is that? What's the game here? It's an independent, standing aside, professional, expert perspective. And I've want to emphasise the word as a holistic review. It's not about the pieces, it's about what the pieces put together mean. That holistic part, in some sense, in my view at least, is the absolute core of why FCRs are valuable and why actuaries are well placed to do it. Because we're used to synthesising and bringing stuff together and saying, this is why you care. Right? So that it goes to the board, doesn't go to management conceptually, it goes to the board, goes to the boss. Confidential copy to the regulator. So it's not a public document, it's an honest assessment. Now we can change that a little bit, but that's the basic point. And the last one is sort of the usual homily. If it's not timely, if it's not accessible, and it's not relevant, we're wasting our time. All right? Now we need to look around some of the other areas where FCRs are much more entrenched in terms of time, and we are seeing and bemoaning the argument that says they're just becoming compliance documents. Well, that's not where they started. So we need to look at that and go, how come that's happening? And if we can work it out when we do FCRs in super, we want to avoid that. I think timely and accessible and relevant might have something to do with it. Lastly and not least, you know, the usual mantra, this really depends upon the user, the recipient, seeing value in it. So maybe you could make the argument that the value's in the perception of the value. It's not us thinking it's important, it's them. So, in terms of guidance, the Institute put out middle of last year, I have to acknowledge Darren Wickham in particular's contribution. He was the ringleader, taskmaster, whip man, whatever you want to call it, in terms of actually getting it out and about. So we've had on the website, the Institute's website, for the last 12 months, a guidance note about FCRs and superannuation. Now, I'm not going to do the obvious embarrassing thing. You know, hands up who's read it. But it's there. And we need to recognise, this is the world first. I mean, no one's done this before. Right, we've taken the concept, applied it to a different field, and codified it in a way that's, I think, reasonably accessible. This is new. It has been applied in some funds, and when I come to the next slide, you'll see the relevance of this, and also parts of it have been applied in more funds. Now, the parts of it being applied is really important from a pragmatic point of view. We are seeing some take-up over the last couple of years of various pieces. I think, from a sort of straw poll, the anecdotal evidence is in the last year, we're not seeing a lot of new take-up. We are seeing, however, and I think this is very encouraging, that most of the people who have taken up pieces in the past have stayed there, stayed with it. In other words, when it's being used, it's very sticky. That's a testimony to the value that's actually added once we've got over the hump of what's in it for me. So we have some runs on the board. In terms of, I suppose, the cricket analogy, we could argue we've got off to a start, so we aren't sitting on a duck. We might be in the teens or something like that, but we have not played a substantial innings yet. So why is that? Well, Stronger Super and My Super are occupying a lot of people's attention at the moment, and they're definitely in compliance mode. Get it done, get it over the line, figure it out later. Bad place from the point of view of marketing FCRs, but that's the reality. In terms of regulatory support, we have, as a group, been and discussed FCRs and the context of them over a couple of long sessions, a couple of hours each, with APRA, and from an internal point of view, and I don't, is anybody here from APRA before I say things I shouldn't say? No? Anybody going to own up? I think it would be fair to say that APRA, in principle, certainly in those meetings, are supportive of the concept and the guidance that we've put out. And I think they would be very pleased if our entities did provide FCRs on a confidential basis, in all parts of them. The reality is, however, that despite that informal and I think probably clear support, it would be fair to say, there's absolutely no chance that they're going to legislate it or put it in regulation in the foreseeable future. Okay, it just isn't going to happen. They're clear on that. We just need to accept that. That's just part of our broader challenge. It's not that they don't like it, it's just they've got other fishes to fry as well. So, overall, what is it? Well, this is a nice short summary. It's a nice one-pager and it's a picture. It's good. It's got five pieces in it. And the fifth one, which is, in my mind, is the holistic assessment, actually is the most important. When we developed this, we did the classic actuarial thing, and we did it from the bottom up. So we started at the bottom of the page sort of thing and worked our way up. We put the bar across the top in at the end. But that's where I think that's where the core of the value is. So there are four pieces, that four legs this holistic stool sits on, if you like. The first one, up here on the upper left, financial strength assessment. It's where you are today as a fund. So this is going to cover things like level the reserves, movements in reserves, trustees' assessment of service providers, trustees' assessment of their own strength, recognition of what are the material risks, and by that I mean the residual risk, not the inherent risk, probably. How's our liquidity going? You know, the things that are happening on a day-to-day basis you can look back on and report on. Sort of bases for experience analysis would be another way of contemplating that, right? But it's inherently retrospective in terms of what it's doing. That's not to say it's bad. It's important to know where you are. But it's also important, particularly from a longer-term governance point of view, to go across to the right, fund sustainability. This is where you're going in the future. Right? And this is one of the core strengths of FCRs in principle. It's not only about where you are now, it's about where you expect to be in 3 to 5 years. Where is your business plan taking you? Right? How do you build your business plan into all those other little financial bits and pieces so you make sensible decisions? So this is looking forward, it's going to include in it projections. Right? It's good, we can make a spreadsheet up for that, or two, depending on how you're going. But it's going to include some specific pieces that come out from the superannuation context. It's going to include assessment and liquidity planning. Right? We have to do liquidity and investment planning. Right? It's in the rules. Right? You have to just go back to that. It's in the rules bit. If you sit back and think about it, you do need to go back and go, why do we have to have the rules in the first place? And the answer is because people aren't doing it. All right, so again, this stuff isn't new, it's just sort of now being enforced because the troops, in the generic sense, weren't as interested as they could have been. So we'll have liquidity. We'll have demographics. Heaven forbid we've got an ageing population. You know, what are they going to do? Well, they're probably going to retire at some point. So when are you going to turn to negative cash flows, for example? I think the anecdotal rule is that whilst no funds at the moment, or very few, have negative net cash flows, despite the fact that's the wrong measurement, at the moment, if you look 10 years down the line, you might be surprised to find that that's going to be far more common than you think. Right? So that, the demographic impact is important. There's an annual scale test that is now in the game rules. Well, you know, you might want to look at it and do it not only retrospectively, but prospectively, because that will be a grounds for whether we stay in business in a particular investment option, like MySuper, for example, or not. So that's the looking forward. The bottom two pieces we have here are, on the one hand, stress testing. Now, actuaries love this because this is called how can you break the system. Well, it's usually called how can you break the model, which represents breaking the system. But anyway, they are slightly different things. But APRA has been on about stress testing for a long time, on liquidity, on unit pricing, all sorts of various things. And why is that? Because the regulator, from a regulatory point of view, looks at it and goes, my interest is in making sure that these entities stay in place so they can satisfy their member needs. How do I make sure they can do that? Well, I don't go and manage them on the good side. I make sure that when things go awry, they've got a good chance of survival. So no doubt we're looking at stress testing. Fiduciary duty must also drive that. Fiduciary duty to members over 40 years must also imply, well, maybe it doesn't because I'm missing something, but to me, it's got to imply that you make sure that you can get through the bad times as well as the good times. That's stress testing. So, you know, maybe the regulator's driving it, but it's not the only one. The last one is what we've called actuarial risk review. And this is where we're looking at it, the risks from an actuarial perspective. And I'll just make the comment. This is not about compliance. That's not what we're on about. That's what you have compliance people for. It's not about internal audit, about whether you actually applied the controls or not. That's what you've got internal audit people for. What we're after, and they're both retrospective, inherently retrospective. What we're looking at is, from an actuarial point of view, what are the risks we can see on the future? How well have they been identified? How well have they been model, and I use model in the absolute loosest sense, as in maybe recognised would be a better word. Sometimes there's a good model there, and sometimes the model's high, medium, low type stuff. But that's still a model in the most broad sense. And are all, well, the usual regulation says all known risks will be covered. If you stop and think about that, it's a really dumb statement. Okay? So all risks implies you have some extra contacts up here. All identified, all known is fine. And that also implies there's a recognition of the unknown ones and what you're going to do about managing those or their impacts. That should be sitting in here. It's no good sitting around and go, oh, we didn't think of that one, so it didn't count. All right? So that's important. And I think the other thing that sits in here is the exercise of, well, there's two ways of looking at this, of aggregating in some form, and I'll use the word adding again in the loosest sense, the impact of more than one risk together to get a holistic approach. So the adding of risks, you know, Josh will kill me for this, but I'm using add in the, you know, the sign is very wiggly here. Or equally, when you start at risk appetites, you've got the opposite problem, which is how do you cut them up to hand them down to the business and the risk tolerances. So the adding and the allocating are flips of the same coin. Now, that's a non-linear, counterintuitive problem. And my experience, others may have others, is when you go and start talking to people, including risk management, if you start talking about adding risks or cutting them up, you know, their eyes glaze over immediately. Right? They just don't see it, let alone even acknowledge there's a problem there. So there's a huge exercise. This is where risk tolerances meet risk appetites or vice versa. That's a huge problem from an intuitive point of view. It's this counterintuitive stuff. Right, so that's where the actuarial risk review sits and plays. And lastly, sitting on top, we have the holistic assessment. This is drawing it together. This is adding whether you add value to the board. Right, and this is where you want the board to come back and say, you know, we understood that, we see we've got an issue, we're going to go and address it, or we have addressed it, whichever it turns out to be. This is where we as actuaries play the role of valued advisor to the business decision makers. Right? It's the board who make the call. Right? Our job is to inform them in a way so they can make better calls. And I think this means it's alerting them to interactions, it's alerting them to leverages, it's what I call helping them develop a sense of consequence. If I do this, then. You know, it's getting insight. I think that means you pretty much... this may be just me because I'm a bit like this. This may mean that, you know, I reckon this means you need to be making some recommendations. Out of all this analysis, we've seen the following things. We suggest you do blah. Or it might be one of two, or we suggest you address, however you want to phrase it. But we need to be proactive in this. That's part of the challenge because that's how do you help make, you know, better decisions. And I think the other thing is, this provides a framework within which you can plonk all the various reforms that are happening. If you can give someone a framework within which to plonk all the things that are happening, suddenly it becomes not this amorphous mass of things that are all running around on the floor. It becomes a structure that you can decide where you want to attack, where you don't, what's important, what's not. So the idea and the concept of an FCR, particularly at this holistic level, is actually a management tool for the board. That, in its own right, without doing any more than that, providing that with a structure as a value add. All right? Because now the game becomes accessible. So that's sort of mostly, if you like, from a background point of view about where we think we're going, and we're happy to have views to the contrary or to enhance it and so on. So, having said that, this could just be us as actuaries running around. Paul Keating had a famous phrase about actuaries and how useful they were to the rest of the world as opposed to themselves. So, is there a need? All right. And this survey that we did this year and last 2 years ago, I mean, I reckon this is pretty clear evidence. So there's a plethora of issues. And so what we did when we did this survey was we took the prior survey and we said, game rule is we're going to ask the same set of questions so we get a comparison. And we'll ask them additional questions because things have changed. Right, so we got, and the idea is to set this up on a longitudinal basis so you can see the trends emerge. And the first trend that emerges is at a sort of, you know, a summary level, the levels of concern where they're comparable, on a, in aggregate, they're going up, they're not going down. Now, for an environmental point of view, you might go, that's not terribly surprising. On the other hand, a lot of stuff that was new for the 2011 survey, so 3 years ago, is now not new. There's other new stuff coming in, but this is, this comparison is between 2011 and 2013. So the level of comfort is not increasing significantly. FCR provides a framework, I've said that, and no doubt there's a need. I mean, the fact there's a need doesn't mean we win, but at least we've got a good argument. So what I've done here is I've just put up, this is a couple of snapshots here, of the level of concern. Now, the survey had a five-point scale, so it could be completely not concerned, a little bit neutral, concerned, or very concerned. So on this graph, concern means either very concerned or concerned. So it's sort of the four and the five, if you like, at the end. The orange bars are 2011. The green bars are 2013. I'm going to wait for the question about tell me exactly what the bits on the right say, but I'm going to step back from that because I'm going to say I don't really care because I'm looking at a picture. And the green bars mostly are the same or bigger than the orange bars. All right, end of story. Now, different things move around, and I'm quite happy to say what these were, by the way, but I just want to focus on the picture and the overall pattern because that's the important message, is that particularly in this block here, all right, down to here, green bars going up significantly. These ones are just sort of bubbling around a little bit. And on the very top, this was the risk of poor fund investment compared to competitors, and the third one was the risk of poor fund investment internally. So top one's external, what the other blokes are doing, and the third one down was the risk of poor investment from the point of view of members, the internal one. They're the two ones that have dropped off most, and I don't know, the cynic in me says, well, GFC, they got poor investment returns, so they got worried. Now we're past the GFC and investor returns have gone up, and they're not worried. Does that mean anything's happened? No, just the external environment's changed. So I'm not sure how to start seriously trying to infer interpretation between those two ones dropping a lot. But I think there's a certain amount of it's gone away, I'll worry about other things going on. Just, I accept that might just be the cynic in me. But the overall message is definitely concerned. Now, the other thing we did, and this was only a 2013 question, because we have the SPSs coming out, and we asked, both in aggregate, how useful do you think they will be, the top question. So, well, I've got concerned, highly concerned. That's probably not quite fair. It should be useful, very useful. Sorry about that. And the blue one is not a problem in various form. And I think it's quite interesting that how useful will they be to the industry? Yep, that's at 50%, give or take. Concern and 15% not. Okay, so yeah, they need them. And we come down to, well, how about for you? Oh, well, yeah, we do, but this is the second one. We do, but not quite as much. And we're actually better off than the rest of the industry. That, on average, doesn't work. So there's something happening here. But I mean, so but to be a little less flippant, these aren't that far apart, really. And these are telling us that there's a significant level of concern, interest, etc., sitting around the SPSs. Now this, in my mind at least, sits slightly contrary to the rhetoric we sometimes hear about what a waste of time it is. So, and then last, we also asked the questions, not at the overall level, but for each SPS individually. And then I took just the average of those, because one's looking down, one's looking up. And, you know, I'm not terribly surprised that when you look at the averages, you get slightly higher than the individual. But I'm quite surprised that, in particular, this one and this one, pretty close to the same. Which means the overall estimate and the components are quite consistent. Now, I didn't go through and do the analysis between each individual fund and all that stuff, so this is on average. But I think there's a fairly clear message here. There's a recognition of the SPS environment has considerable value. FCRs sit right on top of that from a structural point of view and from a point of view of bringing it together. And the last one, now some of you may remember this from the last survey, which is how useful are some of the risk management tools near and dear to our hearts. And stress testing, again, blue is now, orange is 2011. These are in order that they were asked. And I think the striking thing is, particularly of the green ones, that almost all of them are over 60%. That's roughly, I mean, you know, we're experts, we do lots of numbers, that's about two-thirds. Right, roughly about. It's actually, on aggregate, clearly higher than it was in 2011. There's increasing awareness of the value of these tools. Not all the green ones are bigger than the red, the oranges, but most of them are. And some of them are going up materially. We might say they should go further, but that's not the point. The point here is that there's significant concern and recognition of value. And these are all things we do. Stress testing of various forms. Fund projection. Fund sustainability. Oh, that's tomorrow. Analysis of member behaviour. RMS, RMPs, risk management strategy, risk management plans. And it's subsumed under RMFs now, but all basically the same thing. Now, reserves, you know, liability exposure and protection of fund. And then the bottom one, which is on average. So I think the argument of, you know, do we need this? I think this is fairly compelling evidence that a significant proportion, perhaps the majority, of the industry recognises value in this stuff, whether they know they're recognising it or not. And I don't mean that in the flippant sense. It means they see the issues. They may not see that this is the best or optimal or even only solution. So, moving forward, and this is where we need your help. It's a clear opportunity for us as actuaries and from the point of view of the profession to add value. And I liked very much Donna Walker's point yesterday afternoon. This is about where we, as a group, who have a set of actuarial skills, can add value. It's not about us going in as the actuary doing the actuary thing. No, it's a very valuable distinction. This is about taking a set of skills, transferable skills, generic skills, call them what you like, and taking it from an area in which we learnt them and applying them in a new but related area. This is transference of core skills. Right? And it's clearly there. I've said we're on our mettle because we don't have any statutory protection. Well, it's about time we stood on our own 2 feet, in my view. So I actually think... whilst we might be nervous about it, I actually think that's an advantage. And what does that mean? Well, it means we actually got to demonstrate value add. Talk about it, so let's do it. And it's competitive. There are other people out there, rightly or wrongly, and I'm not making a value judgment on them, who can do and will do and are doing, let's make no mistake about that, various pieces of what we think is a useful holistic structure. If we don't get out there as a profession and as individuals and make it clear that we can do this, we can do it well, we won't be doing it. It's quite simple. So I've put down a couple of challenges, but we'd be interested in knowing what your views are. Status quo, right? We're not well known. Sometimes we are in the position of almost being viewed as being perhaps a nuisance. So perceptions of actuaries. I'll leave you to decide whether you agree with that or not. There are different views around, and this is not applicable to any particular person. This is a generic stereotype style view. I know there are exceptions in both directions. There are some people, in particularly in a sense in the superannuation area, who are wonderful exponents of exactly the opposite of these. You make no mistake about that. But they are individuals. What I'm focusing on here is the perception issue that we face from the point of view of being the profession and getting a generic Guernsey, if you like, as opposed to an individual one. It's competitive. And I've put down, because this is a personal bugbear of mine, is price. And I think one of the real dangers of going into this area, and any new area I might add for that matter, is from a commercial point of view, we need to make sure that we genuinely are perceived to add value. Now, we may think you should do lots more stuff and we should be much more precise and all those things, but if that's not what the client wants, it's not what you do. So I think a real danger is avoiding overkill, and I think it's avoiding unnecessary pedantry.
And that unnecessary is from the client's point of view. It's not from ours. And I think that's a big challenge. Because I don't know what you're like. I'm seeing like, oh, that's interesting. I wonder what happens if, right? I'm sure one or two other people in the room are the same place. We have to curb that and put it in someone else's context. So, and the value add, in my view, on my summary of that is, what we have to transform is something that's currently bottom-up and regulator/compliance driven to something that is top-down and of holistic value. So, with that and with that as background, really, it's the discussion here and your views on whether we're on the right track or not, how you think we might address some of these issues. No doubt there are some other impediments that we haven't thought of, etc. So this is the over to you bit.
Yeah, so we're not trying to constrain your thoughts at all, so please make comments on anything, but we're particularly interested in how your thoughts, I guess, on how we promote this further and we overcome those barriers. And also if you have any particular experiences you can share, because sharing those experiences and knowing what others are doing in this area will help the task force then, I guess, plan its approach to, I guess, beating down the doors of the superannuation industry in promoting this concept. So if anybody would like to shoot a question or a comment or an observation to us?
Or Darren. Brad.
Or I will. Thanks, Darren.
I'll be brave. It's Whipmaster Wickham. Thanks, Jules. Or I should say erstwhile Whipmaster Wickham, because Tim Jenkins has now taken the new gig as leading the task force.
Have you passed the paraphernalia across?
the ceremonial whip?
Yeah.
So I've handed over the responsibility to Tim, and I'm very grateful for that. I now work in the life insurance world and not super world. And while I wouldn't claim in any way to be an expert in life insurance FCRs and this, my initial observation is that the insurers have a very much more sophisticated approach to this, to risk management and the integration of that into strategy. And it's made me even more convinced that superannuation FCRs are a really important thing that we should pursue and that they can add value. Mm. And one idea that I'd like to see pursued is there are now lots of actuaries working within the industry fund world, and indeed some are here in this room today. I think we've now got at least three CEOs that are actuaries of industry funds. I think there's an opportunity for the Institute to learn from actuaries working within the industry fund movement, to understand what some of those barriers are, and also to help and encourage actuaries to sort of promote it internally as a concept. So. Mm.
Yep. Thanks, Darren. That's an excellent suggestion. So working from within, rather, at the moment we're trying to work from outside and beat down doors. Well, some people are already on the other side of that door. So tapping into them and getting their assistance is something that I think we should definitely do, and I'm sure is on top on Tim's list. Yes, please.
As one of those industry fund actuaries, just a few observations, I guess. We're a hybrid fund, so the concept of an actuary being involved in the fund is quite normal. Yep. And I guess one of the challenges the Institute will be the pure DC funds. I don't know how many there really are, because even like Aussie Super's got DB sections and so on. But for people that aren't really actively involved with actuaries in the past, whereas for us it was quite obvious. And Jules, you got that chart with the four boxes or the five boxes on it?
Yep. Well, I would if I could make it go backwards. Yeah. There we go.
So it's just a collection of observations, I guess, rather. In terms of the five boxes, we've done a lot of work on the two right-hand boxes there with our actuarial firm, who I know quite well. Built a fund model, a membership model, which basically does the two things on the right-hand side. It projects forward membership and does a lot of work on membership profiles and when cash flow is going to become negative and stress testing illiquid levels in future dates, all that sort of stuff. So that's been extremely well received by the board. They value that greatly in terms of insight into the fund and insights into when to make illiquid investments and the like. And so our actuarial firm's got a great deal of credibility from being seen to be very forward-thinking. We've had our asset consultants spreading the word amongst their other clients as to how clever this work is. So it is certainly possible to get good credibility at the board level. And on the concept of the board level, Jules, I'm interested in this idea of confidentiality. I'm not quite sure that's a good idea in the way to promote this. For a start, APRA see everything they want to see in any case, so I'm not sure you need to give it to them confidentially. And I think keeping it away from management, just giving it to the board, is not the way industry funds work. They work closely together, and the board wouldn't want to see anything that management hadn't been part of. So I question that idea of, you know, sort of a direct link to the board, not via management. In terms of competition, you're right. There's a lot of competition around, and certainly with stronger super and all the focus on risk appetites and the like, there are other parts of the super industry, other professionals have been buying into particularly sort of the left-hand two boxes, but I don't think they can do the whole thing. I guess success perhaps isn't necessary from an actuarial point of view getting the whole package, but maybe getting good chunks of it and then just see how that goes over time.
Thanks very much.
Can I just pursue that with you for a moment? And I'm quite comfortable that, and whilst it'd be ideal to do everything, that the reality is we can't and probably won't, and others will do bits. Let me ask you the question. I mean, I have a view, and I'm happy to be in a minority on that, but actually this is the bit where we can add the most value, which is the drawing together of the work done in the other boxes, whether we've done them, whether we as the actuaries have done it or not. I'd just be interested in your view on the importance of this bit.
Yeah, look, I'm not sure. I think it's sort of emerging, and I'm just sort of trying to reflect quickly on what we do and how that all fits. I think we get a lot out of the work on the right hand two boxes, and I think it probably is where we'll get to, but I think it's a process that is worth aiming for, but it's not something you can sort of snap to overnight, I think.
Well, I mean, if we could, we would have. So, but it's really that it's worth aiming for, and it's sort of that's the holy grail in a grail, at least in a sense.
Thanks. Any other comments or experiences, Rob? Yes, please, Rob. Thank you.
My name's Rob Payton. I worked for many years in superannuation, but I then transferred across to health insurance, and I've done between 15 and 20 financial condition reports for private health insurers. So I provide a unique perspective on this. I gave input earlier. I think the position you've reached of no compulsion is excellent. What you must realise if you come at this from the point of view of life insurance, general insurance and health insurance is that appointed actuaries there hold a continuously responsible role. And the financial condition report is just part of that whole role. And therefore, it's not really the one shot you get at doing things. What I would encourage you to adopt is what I've used for my financial condition reports is that they are the output of a financial condition process, which is really no more than a regular experience monitoring process of the agreed things. That fits in very well with a board and board and management cycles. I think one of the challenges of financial condition reports is the whole management board thing that Grant just alluded to then. Management is very afraid of financial condition reports and goes through them in incredible detail because they don't want them to be critical. So there's a pre-review, then the report goes to the board. And then, of course, the confidentiality is that FIAC must not disclose the financial condition report to anyone. And there have been examples of where financial condition reports have leaked out from FIAC or from APRA. FIAC is the private health insurance regulator. And this is, very, very obviously a very serious matter. So if I was encouraging you for going forward, it would be to look at the drawdown phase of superannuation funds and to apply these techniques in the drawdown phase. So and I agree with you, Jules, that no compulsion is exactly where you want to be. Don't want to be compelled because it's not necessarily a nice place to be if you don't have all of that support that goes with the whole regulatory regime that sits behind life insurance, general insurance and health insurance.
Yeah. Thanks.
Thanks, Rob. That's very good. Okay, well, it seems to be breaking up, but if someone's got a burning question or a bit of insight, I'll take it. I have.
You Michael. Michael Burt, I'm just going to make the point, following on from Rob's comment, is be careful what you wish for. In a voluntary system, it's all very well wishing to have this holistic assessment, but one of the problems with it being a voluntary system is every so often you're going to have to say something that the recipients and the people who are paying you and employing you don't want to hear. And then you're in a really awkward position because either you have to front up and say this is what you don't want to hear and run the risk of being fired, or you tend to get quiet and effectively you become complicit in the problem that may well eventually emerge. So I'll just make the point, careful what you wish for.
Thanks, Michael. Okay, so we might wrap it up then, but I'd encourage you, if you have other questions or thoughts, Tim would love to receive them. Tim is, as Darren mentioned, the new convener of the task force. I noticed there are a few other members here. I think I can see Tony Miller down the back. There's Luke there, and of course Luke Carroll and Jules Gribble. So they're after your ideas. They're after your ideas also in sharing your experiences. They know what the experiences of the people in the task force are doing, but if you have others that can add to these, I guess, the knowledge and the base that they have, that'll only help them as well. So before I thank Jules, thanks to everybody who's on the task force and taking this forward. To Jules, thanks very much for the time you've put into putting this presentation together. I'll reward you with a little gift that it took me ages to choose and purchase on the way. And with that, remember your feedback forms. I think that's it. Okay. So thanks very much for your attendance.